Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome. And we're going to continue our exploration of the forms of consciousness. I think we've all had those moments in our life when we discover something, you know, usually, you know, probably when we're adolescents, when we read something that really, really blows our minds. That isn't just a magical, enchanted world, the kind of things you read when you're, you know, and 11 years old, but then something that you read as you're realizing that kind of magical, relatively safe, relatively contained world where you are a huge part of what's going on, which is kind of the experience of being a kid, we realize that that's not the whole picture. And actually, there's this whole big world out there, and it's not altogether pleasant. And one that does not care altogether about your own fantasies and desires particularly. And that's the point where you really start to need some help to transition. And I think that's often a place where we discover some of the most important writing, at least in my experience, writing that helps modulate between the enchanted world of the adolescent or pre-adolescent and this more stern, conflictual, but still fascinating and delicious world that lies ahead. And for me, one of those texts very much was Blake's Marriage of Heaven and Hell. And I can remember where I was when some older person told me that they thought I would like it. I remember what it was like going to the library, starting to read this thing, which I thought was going to be poetry. And there's kind of poetry in it, but it's not really poetry. It's this crazy, wonderful, mad rant full of prophetic imagery and scandalous aphorisms and dreamlike visions with this sort of dark power. And it was at once sort of dark and light more than almost anything I can think of. I mean, it's got a kind of like heavy metal Satanism to it, and at the same time it's full of, you know, bucolic Christian love and exuberance. And it really marked me and set my my tastes for art, for philosophy, for certain exuberance in living. And so I'm a huge Blake fan, and I was lucky. I got to study a lot of Blake when I was an undergraduate, and had some great, great professors who really knew the stuff inside and out. So I was very happy to see that Eric Wilson's new book called My Business Is to Create, Blake's Infinite Writing, was about Blake and about writing, another topic that I'm into. So I'm very happy that Eric joined us again. This is the second time on Expanding Mind. But before we say hello to Professor Wilson, we'll say hello to not quite Professor Maja Dao. You're not a professor, right, Maja?
I'm a professor of sorts.
What sort are you?
I'm sort of a professor.
I like that.
Yeah.
It could be like it's like an S-PhD.
That's right, exactly. But my grandma used to say PhD just means piled higher and deeper.
Yeah. So for you, like, is there a particular Blake poem or book or image that really has stayed with you?
Well, you know, like you, Eric, I remember exactly where I was when I first was exposed to Blake. I was 7 years old, and my grandmother gave me a copy of Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright. And I memorized the entire thing that first time that I read it. And then she gave me a book of William Blake's poetry. She's a Sagittarius like me. I'm also a Sag, and William Blake was a Sagittarius as well, so I immediately resonated with his work, and from the age of 7 on, that was it. I was hooked, and it was Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright that did the trick.
Wow, yeah, that one stays with you, and it's really quite an enigmatic poem, actually.
Yeah.
It's hard to know, exactly, it's almost the same thing I was saying, where it's beautiful and terrifying, and it's not clear that anybody can really say ultimately what that poem's about, even though it's sort of, you know, it appeals to a kind of childlike sensibility. And I've read, you know, whatever, highbrow professors who've spent their whole life studying Blake, and you go, wow, they don't understand this either. Anyway, speaking of highbrow professors, Eric, thanks so much for being on the show again. Welcome to Expanding Mind.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. I'm glad to be back, and I should say I'm sort of a professor as well. all of us who say we're professors really are sort of professors, even though we pretend otherwise.
No, I can appreciate that. I mean, I'm in grad school right now, and I can see that I don't want to be a professor. I just want to sort of be a professor.
Yeah, so you're pretty.
And one of the things that you're sort of doing, I mean, you've written many books, and even your more heavy duty English professor books are very readable. You've always been very invested in being a good writer as well as a thinker about English literature. But with the new book, which is short and clearly focused, has a practical dimension as well as a sort of, you know, reflective one about William Blake. What were you thinking about? What did you want to achieve with the Blake book?
I think I wanted to achieve two things. I mean, first, I really wanted to, in accessible a way as possible, open the world up to the wondrous fury that is William Blake. I mean, I think you and Manja both are describing him perfectly. I mean, he was a man who at times flashed insanity, at times flashed as an angel would, just an utterly fascinating, complex, heterogeneous human being. Who also wrote utterly riveting poetry. So I've been teaching Blake now for almost 20 years, and I love teaching Blake to my students, and I really felt like I could open Blake up to hopefully a fairly large audience in the book. Secondly, I wanted to imagine William Blake writing a creative writer's handbook. If Blake were to write a book teaching us how to write, what to value in writing, what to do to be a good writer, what would he write? So I tried to sink into Blake's brain, as it were, and generate what I thought would be a writing handbook by William Blake.
Yeah, I think it's a very successful one. And you know, sometimes, I mean, of course, there's a paradox from the beginning, which is that there's nobody like Blake. Nobody, you know, even the Allen Ginsberg or other sort of incredibly creative figures that you can think of who are clearly influenced or marked by Blake. You know, Blake is just so out of the box. You know, it's just like whatever was going on psychologically, neurologically, the uniqueness of his vision. You know, he comes up with this incredible novelty, even though you kind of recognize that he's sort of like a prophetic visionary as well as a poet and this artist, et cetera, et cetera. So in some sense, what can you learn from somebody who's so incredibly different? But that's in a way part of what makes it kind of more interesting than a more typical kind of like craft of writing book.
It's definitely not a how-to sort of book. There are no 10-step series for how to be a good writer. It very much is trying to capture that spirit of Blake, which, as you say, is inimitable. But at the same time, I think we can follow Blake's example in so many ways. And one way I think we can do that is to realize this. When we are at our best as human beings, when we are at our most generous, our wittiest, our kindest, our most intelligent, we are, Blake would say, being artists. Blake had a very expansive definition of what it means to be an artist. He thought that when we sort of realize the spirit within us, we are behaving in an artistic fashion. So even though Blake is sort of sui generis, no one can ever imitate William Blake as an artist, a painter, and a poet, in a way, each of us in our own way, when we are, you know, living well, even if we're not putting pen to paper or paintbrush to easel, we are living artistically. When Blake was 4 years old, apparently a spirit came to him and said, be an artist. In this there is felicity. And he really carried that through his whole life, thinking that if we could all realize the artist within, the world would suddenly become a work of art, a beautiful place.
Yeah, one of the things I think about on that score, and it reminds me a little bit of that famous story that you talk about in the book, where I can't remember, the fellow comes by to visit Blake, and he goes outside, and there's, you know, Blake and his wife Kate sitting there in nude, kind of like reenacting paradise, you know, reading Paradise Lost, and presumably reenacting Eden. And what that reminds me of, that takes up what you were just saying, is what I think of as like the under recognition of the party as a vehicle for life and art. Just, you know, because whether it's a dinner party or a costume party or the mix of people and the events and how the people who are hosting can kind of set up something, how individuals can bring people together, you know, who are maybe more shy, and then create an experience that is outside of the bounds of what we normally think of as art. It's not theater. It's not being filmed. It's not, no one's writing anything. It's all happening in the moment. It's not quote unquote art. And yet in some ways it gets as close to that spirit that you're talking about as anything. And it's something I think a lot of people do, and they're not even aware of it as art. But in a way, that's kind of a good example of that sense of when you're actually just play, you know, it's playfulness, mm-hmm. really.
No, that's exactly it, and that's really what makes, to me, Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse such a wonderful novel, where she really makes very clear what you're talking about, a well-thrown dinner party. It's creating a kind of artificial situation that heightens reality. So you get that wonderful interplay between, this is something that's made, it was not there before, but that doesn't mean that it's somehow false. In fact, it is more real than something not made, because it does heighten and intensify experience. And I think that's one way to start thinking about living as an artist, and that is simply to be deliberate and intentional about how you shape your experience throughout the day. It doesn't mean that you're performing or being inauthentic. It means that you realize that you don't find a world so much as make a world. That perception is perhaps passive. We take in a world, but also perception is active. We shape that world in all sorts of ways, with our disposition, with our mood, but in other more sort of disciplined ways as well, if we're artists. So I think Blake sends that message, and it really kind of democratizes art and gives us all a sort of lesson in how to, you know, charge each moment with a kind of vitality we wouldn't have had otherwise.
Well, absolutely. I think that's one of the reasons that it was so popular in the counterculture, was it wasn't just that he was kind of a visionary and it was sort of trippy like psychedelics. There was a sense of that he was really committed to a kind of vision that could translate, that was not based on social hierarchy, that was not based on sort of like the organization of the world, even though he was clearly a remarkable person and probably never met anybody who was even vaguely like himself. There is this profound sense of democracy, and I think that the quality that you bring across here, that was also a theme in your last book, Against Happiness, was the process, whether you think about it artistically or just in terms of, you know, living your life richly, of paying attention to particulars, paying attention to minutia, really paying attention to singular perceptual experiences as a kind of opening into that deeper creativity, which Blake really supports. So I'd love to hear you talk about that a bit.
Well, for all of his idiosyncratic and wild behavior, Blake is really just trying to return us to the everyday particular world and teaching us how to experience in an immediate way. That's really the problem for Blake, how to have an experience. He says that most of us are controlled by what he calls ratio. And that's a very complicated word for Blake, but basically it means that most of us are controlled by a lowest common denominator of perception. What does that mean? If five of us were in a room and I put a plant in the middle of the room and I said, okay, everybody describe that plant in a paragraph, then if I collated all those paragraphs, I would find, say, five adjectives that recur the most. And I would say, oh, well, that's what this plant is. We all agree that's what this plant is. And if you don't adhere to that, then you're either wrong or a madman. Blake gives an example. Most people look at the sun in the sky, and they see a coin in the sky, and we all agree that's what the sun looks like. I, on the other hand, he says, see a heavenly host of angels crying, holy, holy, holy. But I'm called mad for that. So basically, Blake is saying that most of us have our perceptions controlled by these abstractions that sort of build up over the course of our lives. You know, if I say the word robin, some kind of wispy generality pops in your head because you've abstracted from all the robins. You've seen this kind of general robinness. That's a kind of ratio in your head. So whenever I see a sort of feathery being, I try to plug that into that ratio, so I'm not really seeing that sort of reddish, brownish particular robin at all. I'm seeing retrospectively. So this is why Blake says that most of us don't really experience the world at all. We live retrospectively. We live through abstractions. We live in a world of ghosts, as it were. So how do you break the ratio? Well, that comes with sort of extreme, intense attention to the particular. I mean, Blake says to generalize is to be an idiot. You know, the particular is the foundation of the sublime. And I think this is what he means when he says that when we cleanse the doors of perception, the world will appear as it is, infinite. This is not mysticism. The more closely you look at something, a grain of sand, a leaf, a person, the more complicated and expansive and full and heterogeneous it becomes. So I really think that Blake is teaching us how to see in our own particular way, and this is the basis of living life as an artist. Taking seriously your own experience, no matter how weird it is, no matter how undefinable it is, no matter how far beyond classification it is, kind of extending into the unknown, extending into what can't be defined. And that is sort of seeing the world as this sort of, you know, infinite intricacy and interplay of all sorts of possibilities.
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, he said that so well in the To See a World in a Grain of Sand and Heaven in a Wildflower, you know,
yeah,
that idea. But what I think is interesting is that the kind of artistic groups that pick up on Blake and how he does get interwoven into counterculture and who kind of picked up on that, you can see so well what everything you just said, how some people get what he's saying. And it wasn't really, I mean, you see the surrealists pick up on it, right? It's not until, mm-hmm, like Dolly gets into it, and then like all the Fantomas groups, and then that kind of like leads into how the Situationists take it over and start with their happenings and stuff like that. But I mean, William Blake really was the progenitor of all those kind of conceptual artistic movements when you get down to it. If you read what he's writing about experience and perception and stuff like that, you can really see the connection between those like kind of progressive artistic movements and what Blake laid down.
Now, that's exactly it. I mean, I think of a nice moment in counterculture that you're talking about, would, you know, where, you know, in the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test by Wolf, he talks about Ken Kesey's theory of perception, saying that,
totally,
you know, he sort of laments the fact that, you know, there's a 1/30 second, you know, 1/30 second lapse between what our sense organs take in and our mind making an image of it. And there's this real desire on Kesey's part, you know, to get beyond even that gap, to try to get us as close to the world as possible, immediate, spontaneous, unexpected perception, and I think that's one way to account for Blake's really bizarre style. It's almost, when you're reading some of Blake's later prophecies where he makes up his own mythology, where you look at a word, you think, what on earth does that mean? It's almost like he's trying to tear words away from definitions. And forcing us to face that word as a raw, naked, unadorned particular, and make it mean to us in an utterly unique way. I think that's how Blake wanted to be read. It's almost like you have to be Blake to read Blake well, Blake in your own way, because you have to be imaginative in how you sort of negotiate the utter weirdness of his poems, which really foreclose any sort of systematic interpretation. You know, as Eric said earlier, you know, most professors who study Blake at a certain point just say, all right, I can only go so far. The rest is up to you.
Yeah, and it's funny, though, how that is balanced with a certain kind. There is a kind of system going on. I mean, it's one thing to have a completely uncorked, you know, poet, or to take an example like Finnegan's Wake, which, while it's incredibly structured and brilliant in terms of what the language is doing, like on the surface, you're just completely at sea.
Mm-hmm.
But with Blake, there is a kind of system. There's almost this kind of comic book, theosophical, Gnostic mythology, and there are these characters that we can kind of identify. And for me, it's partly the balance between the incredible emphasis on novelty, on freshness, on the unexpected. But there's also the sense that it's going on not only just in a world, although it's a new world and where you don't really know who these characters are until you start reading the commentary or you study the poems for a long time. But there's also the sense that it's like it's very significant. It has a kind of more than one person. It has a mythological dimension to it. So it's a really interesting. It's like that line in where I guess it's in Jerusalem where Lo says, I must create a system or be enslaved by another man. So there is also a way in which he's saying it's not just about the particular experience or the unusual moment or the fresh word, but it is also about kind of, in a way, mapping your own, not your own mythology, that sounds too new age, but like letting a myth come through you, letting a different kind of system, a different kind of map come through you.
No, that's something we can never forget with Blake. I mean, he knows that we ultimately cannot escape abstraction. We ultimately cannot escape tradition. We can't escape the past. We are utterly informed by it, and to think that we're not is to be duped. This is why he holds Jesus up as the poet par excellence, because he sees Jesus as someone who is thoroughly informed by a tradition, his Jewish training in the Torah, but uses that tradition not as something simply to follow, but as a kind of raw material that he transforms and translates into a form that he makes his own. So Jesus becomes a kind of revisionary prophet who allows us to see the past in a new way and recreates the past for us. So, and Blake does exactly the same thing. Blake is steeped in the Bible. He's steeped in John Milton. He's steeped in Jakob Bjama. He's steeped in Swedenborg. And these figures show through his work constantly, but he's transforming them, transmuting them through his imagination, to where when we read a Blake poem, it seems both strange and familiar at the same time. It's almost like you're stepping into someone else's dream. You kind of imagine the terrain a little bit because you share some of those same symbols, but yet they are quite different. And I think, again, he teaches us to try to look at our own past creatively in a revisionary fashion. So I think for Blake, vision is always revision of one kind or another.
Well, you could talk about that a little bit more, because I think that's a really important point. Like, what does that mean personally? Like, what does that mean? Like, if I'm writing, I am an artist, but I'm working with my own. Who am I? What influenced me? What's the difference between vision and revision?
Well, I think for Blake, they're vision is beyond articulation. Vision, that immediate raw experience we were talking about earlier, simply cannot be represented in word or image. So the minute you try to translate any immediate vision into word or image, you're already revising. You're already sort of looking back at something that's already happened. So I think if you're just aware of that, that opens up all sorts of, how shall I put it? It doesn't make us feel so uncreative if we're imitating a past master. Blake said most artists don't copy well enough. So I think we as sort of individual thinkers and artists should say, okay, I am deeply influenced by William Blake. I'm deeply influenced by John Milton. I'm not going to try not to be. I know that those figures have thoroughly imbued my work. I'm not going to fight against it. But I have to sort of make my own Blake, my own Milton, my own Wordsworth, use them as muses, as inspirations, to kind of throw me out into my own creativity. Walt Whitman says, I'm a teacher of athletes. He who most honors my style destroys the teacher. Another way of saying, if you see the Buddha on the side of the road, kill him, right? We honor the Buddha, we honor Walt Whitman, only insofar as they inspire us, as it were, to create our own works. And when that happens, there's a melding between past and present, discipline and spontaneity.
Well, I think it's important to mention, too, that William Blake was also having his own visions, right? Like you mentioned earlier about that he had the vision that told him to be an artist, but I mean, he would straight up see angels like floating around trees and talking to him. Like he actually had physical intense experiences and visions. And it's the difference, like there'll be artists that will copy other artists, like visionary artists, and they'll look at the art and they'll just be drawn to it, but they don't actually have that experience themselves. And then so they're just kind of copying it, but they don't like embody it. They don't imbue it to the full extent, which is like, you know, how you're talking about like writing as William Blake, to write about William Blake. That's like full-on possession, like where you actually are experiencing these mystic visions like Jesus might have had, or like on that level. So it's kind of different than just copying. It's actually like, you know, it's like sympathetic magic, like shamanic style, you know?
Yeah, that's right. So I may read about Blake's visions, and that may make me hungry to live such a life that I might have visions of my own.
Right.
That's what I mean when I'm not imitating William Blake. I'm not imitating Jesus. I'm using them as a kind of shock, hopefully, something that will shock me out of my complacency, and urge me to open up in such a way that I might have my own particular visions. I mean, I really think that's another part of Blake's aesthetic, is that he's constantly trying to surprise us with his own poetry, and that sends us the message that we endlessly need to surprise ysselves. You know, Percy Bysshe Shelley says that this is what poetry does. It rips away the veil of familiarity from the world, and sort of shows us the world in all of it, in all of its weirdness. And if we, you know, if I'm trying too hard to be Blake, as you say, Maja, then I'm going to sort of normalize the world. I'm going to fit it into Blakean concepts. So how can I follow Blake, but at the same time, as it were, transcend Blake into my own individual vision? Obviously, this is the great problem that all creative artists face.
Right.
Well, and it goes into this. I mean, I note that you know, you've written about Emerson, you talked about Whitman, and what this also points me to is not just looking at it in terms of art or poetry, which on some level we all kind of know that, like, there's got to be something in it that's original, something in it that's novel, that's opening up new possibilities, or it's not really going to be very, very interesting. But I think it's equally true about that even more nebulous world of spirituality, of the spirit, of religion replayed outside of religious context, which of course is also something that's really significant, you know, for Blake. You can be inspired by Blake as an artist, but you can also be inspired by Blake as somebody who's interested in connecting with a deeper world of imagery, of expanding as an individual, of overcoming your more you know, ratio based resentments and jealousies and calculated plans. So there's that, also that freshness that points to that very place where the difference between poetry and spirituality, or an artist's life and an awake monk's life, start to blur as well.
Now, I think jealousy is in some ways Blake's master term for how not to be an artist. You know, to go through the world sort of envious of those whom you think are better than you are. To go through the world trying to reduce everything around you to your own sort of narcissistic sense of thing. This is to live what Blake calls the same dull round. And the way this happens for most of us is that we do sort of latch onto some orthodox system, maybe a religious system, where you try to fit all our experiences into that. So Blake would certainly agree with Jung that religion often gets in the way of religious experience. So I mean, this is another part of Blake. If jealousy is the master term for lack of creativity, Blake seems to say that forgiveness, in a way, is a master term for opening up to the world as creativity, and that is trying to engage the world without judgment, without bias. So I think for Blake, that's where the beginning of the spiritual life is. He says the most sublime act is to put another before you. In other words, not to overemphasize your ego, not to overemphasize your subjectivity as the arbiter of truth, beauty, and goodness, but to open up to what we could call otherness of the world without judgment. That is where the spiritual life begins for Blake. And of course, so many of the orthodox systems, the Anglicanism of Blake's time in particular, probably was more judgmental than merciful.
Great. Well, there's so much more to talk about here. We're going to take a break. You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Eric Wilson, the author of My Business is to Create Blake's Infinite Writing, and we'll be right back after a couple of messages.
listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, Mondays 1 to 2 p.m., hosted by medical school professors and best-selling authors. Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, and Dr. Eugene Zamfiro empowers you with knowledge you can use about herbs, homeopathics, and natural therapies for you and your family. Tune in Mondays 1 to 2 p.m. Visit the archives anytime. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, The Natural Nurse, and Dr.
Do you want to listen to your favorite PRN show in your car or when you're out for a jog? You can download any show on the archives at any time. Visit the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com/archives. We can also be found in the iTunes store under Progressive Radio Network. All our archives are free, so go ahead and check them out. Thanks for listening to the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned to stay informed.
This is Bill Bowie.
And this is Kelsey Flynn.
Of Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability.
We bring you news and interviews
with the likes of Wangari Maathai, Bill McKibben, Hazel Henderson, Paul Hawken, Francis Moore LePay, and many others. Tune in to Sea Change Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network on Saturdays at 7 in the evening.
Are you asking questions about the fate of our planet, your spiritual direction, and how to find meaning in a fast-paced society? Voices of Wisdom with John Jeanette is here to answer those questions and more. Tune in every Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to hear sacred activists and teachers exploring the meaning of contemporary culture. The show is produced by Wisdom University with regular commentary by Jim Garrison and Will Tagle. I'm your host, John Jeanette, and I look forward to your questions.
The Progressive Radio Network, your home for progressive thinkers.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Zawu. We're here with the elegant Eric Davis and Eric Wilson. It's a pretty Eric-y day today. And we're talking about William Blake. And before the break, Eric, you were talking about, you know, Blake's opinions on jealousy and kind of stuff like that. And he was not without his own demons. And I kind of feel like a lot of the things he came to these conclusions by wrestling with issues like that within himself was how he so eloquently was able to describe these things for the artists. And I got kind of into his relationship with Swedenborg, and I don't know if you ever read the material that started out as Why Mrs. Blake Cried, about Blake's like sexuality issues and how that influenced him. And I know Eric had said before about how he did some nudist stuff, which, if I'm not mistaken, some of his nudist activity was with his friend Mr. Butt. Amazingly enough, I always think that's amazing, but that he did wrestle with demons specifically in his sexuality, and that the progeny of the marriage of heaven and hell was his strange relationship with Swedenborg. Can you talk a little bit about what you know about that?
Well, Swedenborg was one of many 18th century, I guess I'll call him, you know, spiritual iconoclasts, including Count Zinzendorf of the Moravian faith, who more and more thought that the traditional split in Christianity between body and soul was erroneous, that the true path to spiritual illumination was through the body, and in particular the most intense pleasures that the body can have, which would be sexual pleasures. So you see Swedenborg and Zinzendorf and others sort of creating this sort of mysticism of sexuality. And Blake was keen on that. He knew those materials. But also, more than anything, I think Blake had himself personally had a very fiery, full libido. He married a young woman, Kate Bouchard. They had a really great marriage, but fairly early on he found out that she could not have children. And the story goes that she thought one should not have sex unless one were doing so to procreate. This upset Blake. Blake actually proposed to her that he bring a concubine into the house. And this is why Mrs. Blake apparently cried. So you see Blake often sublimate his sexual desire. I mean, you can, for instance, if you look at some of his sketches in his notebooks, I mean, a lot of highly erotic pictures. I mean, lots of erect phalluses. In one case, a woman has a cathedral for a vagina. In another case, there's a self-portrait of William Blake with a giant black phallus. I mean, so this is someone who had a very heightened libido, and I think he really knew how there's a struggle in all of us between what society tells us is appropriate for our libido and what we actually want to do with our libidos. So a lot of the drama in his poetry is a sexual drama. Of men desiring women in such a way that they're constantly trying to control them, of women constantly trying to evade the men who are trying to control them.
He does have a lot of kind of rapey images, huh?
Yeah, yes, absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's also his figures, you know, we haven't really talked about his art, and it's interesting. I mean, I think you might think, well, if you had never seen Blake's images and, you know, you heard this talk about visionary realms and these coming up with, you know, channeling these characters from your own mythology or whatever, you wouldn't expect that the images themselves are so incredibly well defined.
Yeah.
You know, they're so detailed, and that whole, all that conversation we had earlier about detail and the singular really comes through these forms, which even though they, you know, often his, the bodies have this kind of, you know, a comic book perfection to them, where they're very you know, strapping and muscly or shapely, but they are also very much their own, those particular bodies. So you can kind of see literally part of the dynamic that we're talking about by looking at these by looking at the way he brings the human form into perception with his art.
Yeah, I mean, Blake was trained as an artist. He never had any formal schooling, but he was trained as an artist from a very young age, and he really valued the what he called the line. I mean, he thought the artists who were too nebulous, too emphatic with their colors were bad artists. I mean, so there is a kind of very etched, sort of ripped quality, we would put it now, to Blake's human bodies. And what's interesting about how he uses his images, we really haven't talked about this yet, is that if you read a later Blake book, a prophetic book, he would have published it himself. He came up with a way to publish his own work. No commercial press would publish it. It was so strange. And on one page, you would usually see the poetry. And on a facing page, you would usually see an image that would relate to the verse. Now, usually we think of an image in a book simply illustrating a point in the book. Well, that's not true of Blake at all. Oftentimes, the image and the text are in opposition to one another, commenting on one another, mocking one another, satirizing one another, sometimes reinforcing one another. So there's this interesting interplay between word and image. It is always creating a kind of third term in a way. I think if Blake lived now, he'd be a filmmaker. I mean, he's so interested in how word and image interact with one another to create, you know, patterns that wouldn't be there without the interaction. That film would really take him, and it's not for nothing that filmmakers like Jim Jarmusch, with his film Dead Man, is, you know, profoundly influenced by William Blake in that regard. That's connected to what we're talking about. But, you know, just to go back, Blake's rendering of the human anatomy alone is very, very, very stark, defined, and there is something kind of comic bookish about it. Eric, I agree with that. Yeah.
What do you think about the whole kind of commitment that you have to writing about writing? Like, why write about writing rather than just like write about William Blake and what's inspiring about him, what's interesting about him? Like, what is it for you that did led you to want to write about the process of writing?
Well, the main reason is that I really feel like that without William Blake, I would not have chosen the path that I chose. And both of you were talking about how Blake struck you early on in your careers as thinkers and writers. I had a very similar experience. You know, I'd read Blake in undergrad, and I was taking quotations from Marriage of Heaven and Hell, and you know, typing them and pasting them all around my wall. No wonder I had a hard time getting a date. But you know, they were all those great. You know, the tigers of wrath are wiser than the horses of instruction. The fool who persists in his folly will become wise. You only know what is enough when you know what is more than enough. All those great quotes. Exuberance is beauty. So you know, just to think about how one figure's example in life really it sort of inspired me to develop like I've developed. I remember being in my PhD program, being in a seminar in which Blake was being discussed in a very scholarly kind of way, and I thought, I don't want to be a scholar of Blake. I want to be Blake. And I actually left grad school for about 2 years, thinking I would not go back, that I would just try to make it as a poet and a writer. Well, that didn't quite work out. I ended up going back and getting my PhD and becoming sort of a professor. but you know, this book is in many ways a kind of cloaked confession of how William Blake's example in his life and in his work have really sort of inspired my own writing habits, how I relate to writing, how I go about writing. And again, you know, I don't feel like I have any more authority than anyone else to tell people how to write. That's not what the book's about. I think the book is very much, I hope, a meditation on the magic of writing, the wonder of writing, the power of writing, as manifested by William Blake, but also packaged in a way, expressed in a way that those who are accomplished writers or aspiring writers can glean something from the book that will enrich not only their creative life, but just their everyday life as well. Certainly, Blake's done that for me.
Well, yeah, I think go ahead, Maja.
Oh, another thing you bring up in the book is not just that, you know, he's kind of dedicated his life to this, but that he can't not do it. And you talk a little bit about his death and kind of like, you know, the end of his life. Can you tell folks a little bit about what revelations you had about what the events surrounding his death?
Yes. It's just a wonderfully touching moment. You know, here's Blake. He has an illness of the liver. He's been ill for a long time. He knows the end is approaching. He's in his bed, what will be his deathbed, one Saturday. To the very end, he's still working. He has a sketch pad out. He's sketching illustrations for a version of Dante's Divine Comedy that he's been commissioned to illustrate. At a certain point during the day, he feels so tired. He feels his consciousness waning. He thinks, okay, this is the end. It's time for me to put my pencil and my sketch pad aside. This will be the last thing I create. So he did, and he settled down into bed essentially to die. But then in the corner of his eye, he sees his wife, Kate, there sitting beside of him, and he suddenly perks up and he says, Kate, thou hast ever been an angel to me. Bring me my things. So she brings his sketch pad and his pencil back, and he sketches her. That's the last picture he ever drew, and once he finishes that sketch, he hands it to her and then sort of prepares to die and, you know, starts singing hymns of his own making, legend has it, and basically fades away with his own hymn still sort of trilling in his head. And apparently Blake's wife didn't grieve very much at all. One can speculate that's because, as she once said, I have very little of Blake's company. He's always in paradise. So there's this sense that, you know, William Blake, he worked every day, even though he was extremely poor, made very little money from his art, and often was creating art that he knew no one would buy, no one would look at. He did it anyway, every day, you know, for 12, 13, 14 hours a day, dealing with all these chemicals and a very meticulous process of engraving. He was so committed to his art. He's an example to all of us. I think so many of us as writers say, well, I'll wait till inspiration comes. I don't work unless inspiration comes. Blake would say, work every day no matter what. This is how writing is made. Blackened hands, inhaling fumes, bleary-eyed, being tired. You have to keep pushing through that. So in some ways, this is a much more heroic example of the artist than the one we often have of, say, you know, the beat poet sort of being spontaneously inspired and jotting something down and that being that, or the romantic poet like Wordsworth walking and doing, you know, composing a poem in his head, writing it down, and that's that. I think Blake gives us a much more realistic example of what it's like to create art. It's hard, it's messy, and often unsuccessful. How can you keep going in the face of that? Well, his example suggests how.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of paradox, you know, in everything, but certainly in creativity and And I think that's one of the key paradoxes that you deal with towards the end of the book when you're talking about dictation and inspiration, where, you know, on the one hand, there is something like inspiration,
yeah.
and we all know what it's like, whatever art we do or work we do. And yet, even though in some sense it seems like the goal to create art or to create writing is to be inspired, that's only a really small part of the time. And we do have this romantic idea, in a way, this distortion that's brought on by a kind of story about figures like Blake or other romantic figures, where they're just inspired, and it just comes through them like it's some kind of prophetic overflow. And because that is part of the experience, that's even figured in the writing, or it's figured in the lore, because it's almost an analogy for a way to relate to creation, to that freshness, to that flux, to that into that inspiration. But as you say, the reality is that there's just a lot of drudgery and just kind of dryness and waiting and stumbling in the dark, and that's all part of the process too. So it's really kind of challenging, you know, especially if you're addressing the issue of creativity, of writing and how to write, how to balance those things, because you need them both, but you can't really control. You can't really control them.
That's exactly it. You know, Blake has these wonderful passages where he talks about a fairy came and sat on my desk and dictated to me this poem. Or, you know, I'm simply, in writing my poem Milton, dictating what was already written in eternity. So certainly Blake did believe in that immediate revelation, inspiration that led to, you know, perfect poems in which a line should not be blotted. He believed in that, and I think he had those experiences. But those experiences are not separate from the drudgery you're talking about. And I think that's really, you know, the razor's edge of being a good artist. How do you balance between just working, and then, you know, relaxing, and opening yourself to the newness? You know, if you try too hard to aim a baseball, you're not going to hit your target, right? If you try too hard to aim an arrow, you're not going to hit your target. So how can you find that sort of exquisite middle ground between effort and spontaneity?
It's kind of that moment that musicians experience, right? Where after you have to practice a song for so many hours before you can get to that level where you just flow, right? It's the point where the athlete has practiced,
yes,
that three-point shot where he no longer has to aim and it can just flow out of him. But to get to that point requires so much dedication and hours that before you get into the flow, a lot of people like to almost romantically leave out the drudgery, leave,
yes,
out the hours that go into it, you know?
No, you're so right. And actually, I talk about athletics in my book. I mean, to me, that's the perfect analogy. I think of someone like Michael Jordan who looks, you know, the spontaneity, the playfulness and grace that he brought to the sport of basketball, yes, as you say, is the product of, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of highly unpleasant working out, sweating, etc. So,
right.
You know, I think most of us either want the spontaneity without the effort, or we can go the other extreme, right, and just train and work and press, you know, wanting a certain outcome, which ensures that you will not get that outcome. So,
totally.
So I think that, you know, I like the word grace in this regard. I mean, grace is bodily, and we can learn grace by training, but also grace is something given without dessert, right? So, you know, there's certain moments you're in the zone, certain moments you're in the flow, and you can't predict when those moments are, no matter how hard you train. Sometimes they just come to you. And I think those are the moments when the fairy comes and sits on the desk and recites the poem to you. It's a moment of grace. But as you say, without the training that made the mind the graceful in its discipline, that other kind of grace never comes.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of a Zen meditation teacher that I you know, was practicing with for a while, and he talked about a metaphor for meditation even as carving the dragon. And what he meant by that was, like, that was the work that you did was like craftsman work. You were doing craftsman labor by just sitting. And it didn't mean anything was ever going to happen. The dragon might not show up. But when the dragon showed up, you had nothing to do with it, but you were kind of preparing for that moment. You were carving. You were creating this kind of, you know, practice that in its own sense can be very dry. Mm-hmm. And I think another part of this, at least in terms of writing, which I think is kind of different than music in this sense, is that the fairy might come for, like, you know, for like 5 seconds. You know, you're like sitting there and you're like, oh God. And then you go, oh yeah. And you get that one word, or that one turn of phrase. And it was like, that was the right thing. And then bam, and you're like, the fairy's gone again.
Yeah, I know. We know T.S. Eliot in Four Quartets talks about, we have the experience but miss the meaning, right? We're always having these, often we don't get the visionary moment till after the visionary moment's gone, right? I mean, it's, and you know, I think that's just part of the realism of creating, right? It can be a heartbreaking process, but man, when you get in the zone or get in the flow, there is absolutely nothing better. And you know, all of us have been there who take writing or music making or painting seriously. Those are what Emerson calls those delicious awakenings, and those are enough to keep us going for many dry years, I think, just the hope that one will come again.
I love how T.S. Eliot describes those moments in Four Quartets. He says, sudden in a shaft of sunlight.
Yes.
Right? So
yes.
Good.
I love that. Yeah, quick, now, here, now, always.
Yeah.
Ridiculous, sad waste time after. Just gets
so
it perfectly.
Good.
Yes.
What about what it's like teaching this kind of stuff? Like when you have your students, do you feel like they're inspired to that kind of creativity? Is it actually hard to get through the kind of mind that's like, oh, I'm in school, I have to like write a paper, I got to. Like, do you feel that like Blake has that? Have you seen people kind of turned on through exposure to his approach to art and creativity in the classroom?
It's a very fine line, because here I am, you know, teaching someone like William Blake, who is a consummate iconoclast. You know, I must create my own system or be enslaved by another man's. And we're really trying to capture the spirit of William Blake, his imagination, the strangeness of his work. And then I say, okay, now you have to write an essay analyzing this poem. You need a thesis, you need evidence. And I feel the double bind of that. And, you know, I try to say to them some of the things we're saying, that, you know, in order to bend the conventions, you first have to master those conventions. But a lot of times for 21-year-olds, it's hard for them to quite to get that. So, you know, I just try to be aware of it. I try to tell them, look, these writing assignments are exercises. They're not necessarily intrinsically valuable. They're ways to help you meditate intensely on William Blake, and hopefully, you know, once you finish this assignment, you'll go out and you write your Blakean poems, or you'll, you know, try to embody Blake in your own way. But it very much is this fine line between studying conventions to the point where you master them, and only then can you transcend them. I mean, it's interesting. I'll tell a quick story. You know, I once heard of a story who took a class in Zen Buddhism, and for his final paper, he turned in 10 blank pages, thinking he had captured perfectly the spirit of Buddhism. And the professor gave him an F, and the student was outraged, and the professor said, well, if you're truly a Zen Buddhist, you won't care that you've gotten an F. Right, so I often get students who try to turn in sort of Blakean prophecies instead of papers. I don't give them apps, but it's kind of a similar situation.
Well, but it's also an issue is that, you know, you're clearly experience the craft of writing as a poetic exercise, an artistic exercise, and you write well, and your best sentences are, you know, gleam like jewels and all that, but you are, you know, largely writing criticism. I mean, not so much with the last couple of books, which are a little more experimental, but a lot of the books you've written do fit in that vein. So there's also even a way of approaching the task of having to write a paper where you are engaging those deeper poetic aspects of the self, and that's something that often gets very, very lost in academia and in the kind of the study of whatever literature, religion, you know. But a lot of the great critics and the great scholars write beautifully, and there's a kind of poetry in that as well that's subtler, because it's not like saying, "Hey, I'm doing a poem here, check it out," you know. But it can also, it also really changes our eye, changes our vision.
You're so right, and it is good to remember that. I mean, my literary critical heroes, people like Northrop Frye, the great Blake scholar, Hugh Kenner, the great Pound scholar, they're writing, I would say, poetical criticism. I totally agree with that. And that's something that is lost in the academy, and even lost even more in grad school, where you find some of the worst writing imaginable. utterly, jargon-ridden, unreadable prose. So to bring elegance back into literary criticism is certainly a worthy goal. I mean, the best critics are eloquent writers at the same time.
Yeah, that's actually my experience of grad school. That's like one of the things I find the most baffling. I don't understand why that's not seen as like a necessary part of the craft is to be as eloquent and articulate as possible. It just kind of blows my mind, but that's just the way it is.
yes.
So what about you? Are you gonna what kind of are you planning your own mytho Blakeian vision, or what do you see yourself doing now that you're kind of opening up your writing to direct different kinds of audiences? And what are you thinking about the next move?
Well, I'm actually thinking about writing a book that is quite unambitious and humble. It's called How to Make a Soul. I'm deep into John Keats as well, as you might imagine. He has this wonderful letter called The Veil of Soul Making, in which he talks about how when we're born, we're just sort of indifferent, abstract identities, and the only way we become individuals is that we become souls, and the only way to become a soul is to struggle mightily with the mystery and the pain and the melancholy of the world. So I just thought it'd be interesting to talk about various ways we think of a soul, in the Western world in particular, and to think about a soul not as something given, something that we access, but as something you make, and what that means. So a lot of Keats will be in there, a lot of Blake, a lot of
Socrates' whole deal too, right?
Yeah.
Like he thought philosophy was literally soul making.
That's exactly it. Yeah. So totally. I'm just going to play around with that. I mean, it's pretty early in the game, but I think that would be an interesting book to write that would allow me to bring a lot of my interests and obsessions.
I'm curious. Do you like James Hillman's work?
Oh yes, I do.
Yeah,
very much.
Because I hear a lot of that in some of the echoes, particularly when you're talking about the difficult parts of the soul making and how that feeds into this. I mean, it seems to be a very resonant theme. Well, I'm really glad about that. It sounds like a great book. We got to go now. So, Eric Wilson, thanks for being on Expanding Mind.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on the show.
And once again, Eric's book is My Business is to Create Blake's Infinite Writing from Maja and me. Keep your minds open.